I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, John Kinder. Welcome, John.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
I'm really pleased that you're here. You've written a book, a biography, titled The Cannon of Ancona. And further down, there's a sort of a subheading for it all, subtitle, Raffaele Martelli, Missionary in Western Australia. Congratulations.
Well, thanks.
Let me tell you straight off, for a lot of reasons, I found it a great read. I really wanted to start off this discussion, though, by showing you a photograph. Do you know that guy?
He's my man. He's been a close companion of mine for the last 12 years. And he's taught me a lot.
How did you get to meet him?
Well, Father Martelli, he was a canon, and that was an old-fashioned sort of honorary title in the Catholic Church. We don't have any canons in Australia. But it meant that he was a special priest in his hometown. The bishop had a few priests called canons who would stay in the cathedral and help him run things. So this picture of Martelli here, not very smiley, but people didn't smile in photographs in those days.
Well, photography was still relatively new, particularly here in the West.
Well, and you had to hold the pose for about 30 seconds, so you'd get an aching jaw if you smiled too long. Look, I met the guy because I used to hang out, and I still do, in New Norcia quite a lot. I'd go up there for weekends and various things. And one of the priests, one of the monks up there said to me once, oh, you teach Italian, because I was professor of Italian at UWA while I was gainfully employed. And the monk said, look, we've got these letters in Italian by this priest. And so people have read a few of them, but we don't really know who he was, why he was here, what he was about. Are you interested? And I thought, golly, that's good.
That just amazes me. And people, when they've read this book, will say, what do you mean that the monks and others up at New Norcia didn't know really anything about him?
Well, there are 200 letters that Martelli wrote to the monks up there in Italian. And there's another 200 he wrote to them in English, which is a story in itself. We might come to that. The monks up there have got this beautiful, huge archive. It covers all the years of Salvato from 1846 to 1900 and after that as well. They know what's there, but they've got so much stuff they can't possibly go and get all the history of every single individual in the archive. So at this stage, this is like about 12 years ago, as I say, they said, we know his name, where he was from, but we don't know how he got here. We don't know why he was here. Would you like to help us find out? So I thought, this sounds great.
They were probably aware that he wasn't, in a sense, one of them. He wasn't a Benedictine.
He wasn't, although in the cemetery, he's buried in New Norcia, in the cemetery. His graveyard says OSB, Order of St. Benedict, which is a mistake. I think they all loved him up there. In fact, when he died, they dressed his body in the habit of the monks as a kind of gesture of affection. But he was never a monk. He thought about becoming a monk. But he said in his 40s, oh, I'm too old. I'm used to freedom and I couldn't bend to the discipline of the cloister.
We'll come back to discipline. It's a concept that for me is redolent in this book and in his life. Although probably like lots of good parish priests who have bishops over them and nuns who have bishops over them, they strive away to be independent just the same. But we're in the west end of Fremantle, John. And I'm pointing that way, a little bit south and a little bit west. And it was in 1853, I think, when Canon Martelli, as he liked to be called, turns up here with a bunch of guys. Am I right?
You're correct.
And who were the guys?
Well, yeah, they landed at Bathers Beach, 44 of them, led by Bishop Salvato, who had helped found New Norcia a few years before. He'd gone back to Europe, collected 43 people with him to get the mission at New Norcia going. Now, they were all Benedictines, except for Martelli. Now, there are lots of question marks in the story. You know, people didn't keep records thoroughly, and Martelli's years in Italy were years of war and stuff, so things have got lost. Basically, Ancona is a reasonable-sized city.
There's a beautiful older photo taken from, or made, not a photo, a painting from the 1860s.
Yeah, exactly.
People know the Adriatic may have been there. The Adriatic's a sort of an unsung part of Italy.
Well, that's right. Everyone goes to the other beaches, you know, Amalfi, Capri, and around Genoa and that. This is the east coast of Italy. So from there, you look over to Yugoslavia and the Slavic countries.
The Greeks saw quite a bit of this coast, though.
The Greeks settled Ancona before Christ, and they still call themselves the Doric city, the Anconas. It's over 2,500 years old. It's a city the size of Bunbury, with 2,500 years of history. It's a beautiful kind of contradiction. So, and Ancona's the only port, really, between Venice in the north and Brindisi and Bari in the south. So there's this long, beautiful coast, and this very small but very strategically important city of Ancona. It's part of the Papal States, because in he was born in 1811, and at that time, Italy was not Italy. It was divided into different little kingdoms under the control of Austria or France.
So, John, I just watched The Leopard on Netflix recently. I saw the original film with Burt Lancaster and absolutely loved it. And people who have will understand something about the unification of Italy in this sort of period.
That's a terrific show, The Leopard. I loved it. I love Burt Lancaster, but actually Claudio Cardinale in the original. Unforgettable. So Italy, the Italian peninsula, put it like that, was this collection of kingdoms and duchies and states, all under foreign control, with a central bit that was controlled by the Pope. And the Council of Trent, the Catholic Council of Trent, said that anyone who tried to take away the political control from the Pope would be excommunicated and go to hell. So it was a serious issue.
Well, Donald Trump probably thinks something like that at the moment. The Pope's exercising too much temporal power, John.
Oh, but I think he'll send his vice president to give some theological advice to the Pope, so all will be well.
But going back to this time, this is one of the things I love about your book, is that it's got this partly theological content to it, but how did this man who sort of grew up to be a priest come here to Western Australia? But I'm learning all this stuff, and I thought I knew a bit about Italy, but you've been placed in Ancona, Papal State, and things are happening as he's growing up. Born 1811. Or tell our listeners a little bit about how he grew up. And was he a smart kid?
He was a very smart kid. He was the youngest of eight kids. And I'm the eldest of eight kids. So there are lots and lots of connections actually between me and the good canon. He was born in 1811. And at that time, the king of Italy was a fellow called Napoleon Bonaparte. Frenchman running around. He had declared himself King of Italy and was making enemies of anybody in the church and anybody in the Italian peninsula. However, there was a lot of support for Napoleon among middle-class people, because they thought that Napoleon would chuck out all the aristocrats and create new opportunities. Martelli's family was a middle-class family. They were comfortable, lived in the middle of Ancona, nice big apartment. When he was born, and he was registered with the city council, his first name was Napoleon, which is a bit heretical, really. When he was baptised, though, the priest must have slipped in another name, and he was always known as Raphael. He went to school, excelled at school, and as soon as he finished high school, he went straight into the seminary to become a priest.
Now, this is where you have to explain to our listeners. Some of us were brought up, half on my mother's side were all Irish. The notion that if you were brought up in Ireland, the eldest girl became a nun, the eldest boy became a priest, or perhaps the youngest of each. Somebody had to be given up. You get the impression it was a bit the same in Italy, is it? Did you think how it worked, or did he have a sort of deep vocation, as people call it?
Yeah, that part of Italy had a huge number of priests. I think at one stage there was one priest for every 25 people in the countryside.
Say that again.
One priest for every 25. I should check it.
My goodness, it'll be close to that. Why?
Because the place was very poor. There were small villages everywhere. Each village had its own pope, its own priest. And it was, as you said, in the Irish situation, it was a easy way for families to get rid of lots of children. The priests were often poor themselves, very poorly educated, and didn't always live very happy lives. There were a few, though, like Martelli, who were, you know, very gifted and very intelligent guys, and they were bound for a career. So Martelli leaves school, goes into the seminary. At 23 years of age, he is ordained a priest. He immediately gets appointed to be professor in his own seminary.
Wow.
So he's a bright fella and he's heading for a good career.
He's recognised by his peers and the authorities, you might say, yeah, particularly around Ancona.
Absolutely. And he started to write things in magazines, little essays and poetry. Wow. And so on.
Where did he stand somewhere, so far as Napoleon was concerned? Did he carry the family values?
His family were what were called liberals. And in Australia, liberal means a certain set of things. But in Italy, at that time, liberals were people who believed in liberty and in constitutional government. In other words, government should be voted by the people and they should be controlled by a constitution. Now, that was very dangerous stuff when most parts of Italy and of Europe were controlled by absolute rulers, kings, queens, popes, emperors, and so on. Martelli's oldest brother went to war with Napoleon against the English. So they had shed blood.
They had skin in the game.
Absolutely. Martelli, though, Kevin Martelli, Raphael Martelli, shared these beliefs, but curiously kept his head down. There's no indication at all, while he's a young fella, that he was actually involved in political action or anything. He's just learned to be a priest, then he's a professor. But quite quickly, in the seminary, he starts to introduce new books into his education program.
Oh, well, you often burn the books when this happens.
Well, you see, that's... You can, if you want to achieve change in society, you can go to the top and try and change policies and governments and stuff, or you can start at the bottom.
Or you can read the Canon of Ancona.
Well, that's the quickest and most effective way of doing it. So he was known to the police.
To the police?
Police.
What? Why?
As the leader of the young liberals. Now, not young liberals in Australia, as the young patriots who were trying to get rid of the Austrians and the French and the Spanish and the Pope as a political thing. Martelli loved the church and loved the Pope, but he wanted the political system to be independent.
And that's an issue really that again resonates over the next 100 years or so after Martelli.
Well, Italy had a very particular situation, because in the middle of the Italian peninsula is this town called Rome, which is the centre of the Catholic Church. And so any attempt to unite the country always had the stumbling block of the Pope in Rome. And to take Rome off the Pope meant that you would be kicked out of the church. So it was a very serious issue.
Well, this is why... one of the many reasons I loved reading your book, because it's, as I keep intimating to our listeners, it's not just about a Catholic priest. It's about a time in Italy. First time I went to Italy, there was big communist demonstrations on. The trains were stopped, and I made inquiries as to what was happening, and I discovered they were demonstrating because they wanted basically free primary education. They wanted people to have jobs, and it just sounded like everything we had in Australia. And at that point, it had since the turn of the 20th century. So he also wanted kids to be well educated from memory. In your book, he had these quite social issues in the upper part of his mind. But what about the church? Did he see that Rome as a hindrance to all of this?
Not as a hindrance exactly. He hitched his cart to a particular movement among Catholics, among political Catholics in the 1840s, and led by a fellow called Gioberti. And Gioberti said that Italy had 18 centuries, 1,800 years, of cultural life and religious life that were intertwined and you couldn't separate them. So he was very famous. He said, you can be a Catholic without being Italian, but you can't be Italian without being Catholic. And that, I got to Italy probably about the same time you did in the 1970s, and everyone seemed to be Catholic, but most of my friends seemed to be communist as well, and there was no problem. It's a very, very unusual and very exciting place. Anyhow, Martelli wanted to get rid of all the foreigners out of Italy, so Austrians, Spaniards, a lot of them. He wanted Italy to stay as a kind of federation of different states because the country is small but very diverse. He wanted the Pope to be the president. Kind of hands-off president, but president. And that looked very attractive to many people at the time because it kind of kept them in the church and it, but kept them patriotic Italians as well. But then things went quickly pear-shaped.
Well, this is a bit, yes, one needs to get one's head around. We know he turns up here, when is it, August 1853.
Mm.
He's just 42 years of age. He's just had his 42nd birthday a little bit earlier in the year. He comes in with Salvado, central figure. I must say, Salvado comes through in your book better and more interestingly than I've ever really depicted Salvado. Highly cultured, aristocratic, landed gentry, plays piano, speaks languages, writes, and has got all of these ideas. And so along the line, you're going to tell us how Martelli meets him. But we get Martelli here on David's Beach with these 40-odd Benedictines and so on. What happens to him, this talented guy, first name Napoleon, is going to take over and unify Italy and bow to the Pope and tell him to sit up there and unite them all in the 1840s when he's in his late 20s into his 30s and as an early 40-year-old. What happens in that decade or more?
Well, yeah, that explains why he was here, but it explains how he lived here for 30 years. What happened was, in 1846, a new Pope's elected. He's young, he's good-looking, he's charismatic, and he's been called the first mass media Pope of the modern times. So his face was all over the place. There was on, drink coasters for tables, for scarves.
Eat your heart out, Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah, now Trump's an amateur compared to this. This was Pius IX. And he had a reputation for being a liberal pope. He wasn't a liberal at all. He was proud to be Italian. He wanted Italy to be united in some way, but he wanted things to stay the way they were. People like Martelli heard Pius the Ninth say a few things about the glories of Italy. They thought, you beauty, this is our chance to finally drive the foreigners into the sea and make the country a united place. So in 1848, just 2 years after the Pope was elected.
Famous year in Europe.
The year of revolutions, they call it. From Vienna to Paris to Poland, the whole of Europe kind of tried to chuck out the old regime. Italians went to war against Austria because Austria controlled Venice and kind of over to Milan, most of northern Italy. The Pope said they shouldn't go. But he also said in a very famous speech, God bless Italy. Well, God bless Italy, something popes never said because Italy didn't exist as a political thing. It was a peninsula, it was a tradition. Anyway, people heard what they wanted to hear, and off they went to war. And Martelli signed up as a military chaplain in
the
army.
He signed up as a military chaplain. So he's got mates. I mean, there must be a whole bunch of these. Later on, they were called Young Turks, but here they're Young Gibertis or whatever.
That's right.
How old is he at this stage? And what does it mean to be a priest in this setup?
Well, he's in his mid-30s. And he never took up arms, and he says that, but he had huge authority among the young people. And in fact, he was a military chaplain to a battalion that was called the Roman University Battalion. So these are students, university students, who walked from Rome to Venice, and that's about 600 kilometres. They walked there carrying their ragbag uniforms and rifles and stuff. But the priests were their chaplains, they were their moral guides. In this holy war, they said it was a holy war to drive the Germanic barbarians out of the country.
I suppose as you say that to me, I'm thinking they're almost a representative of the Pope amongst these military forces.
Well, they were, but then the Pope came out and said, well, no, actually, I can't support this war because Austrians are Catholics and Italians are Catholics, and we can't have two members of the same family fight. So by this stage, though, Martelli and his friends are at the front lines and they're caught. They engage the Austrians, they get roundly beaten by the Austrians, and they have to walk back to Ancona in the middle of summer. Lots of these students died of their wounds or of malaria, mosquitoes. Martelli gets back to Ancona and he's now persona non grata.
He's still what, notionally Canon Martelli, and he's still notionally professor of rhetoric or something at the seminary.
He's a professor, he teaches in the high school, he loses all those jobs. I think he probably jumped before he was pushed.
Ah, so he suddenly found himself not stateless or homeless, but jobless.
Yeah, he lived on private lessons, and he had powerful friends who kind of supported him, but his days in the seminary were over. Although, you know, there's another priest who he was in contact with in a city not far from Ancona, who actually gave his students a pistol and said, off to war and drive those Austrians out. That was not what priests should do. This other fellow got in big trouble as well, but sat it out and eventually got his job back. Martelli, though, had this kind of quick temper where I don't think he could sit things out.
That's interesting, because I've not, and we'll get there soon enough, when he finds his way here. Mm. He seems to put his, largely, head down and disciplines himself. Listens to the counsel that he gets. Prudence seems to be his big moral in life.
Yeah, I suspect he went into a sort of a depression. It's not a word they used back then, but there are words like that. And the only way he could see himself building a new future for himself, he's now sort of late 30s, is to be a priest as a missionary. So to buy out of the whole political game. He tried it, he got burned. Now he had to be a different kind of priest.
And he's still, in that sense, connected to his God. He's a priest, he takes it seriously. He hasn't abandoned that and gone off to, you know, tend to the grapes in Tuscany or somewhere.
Well, when I first became aware of him and started looking through the archives in Italy, I went to the Vatican and different parts of Italy, I was looking for this really salacious story, you know, a guy who, you know, went through a crisis, chucked it all in. It's nothing of that, actually. He went through a crisis, but he never lost his belief that the meaning of his life was to serve the faith that gave meaning to everything.
Now, can you tell our listeners this concept of being a missionary? It wasn't exactly new in the mid-19th century, and the Spaniards in particular had been doing it in South America for some years, not always to great acclaim, but sometimes they were well mentioned. But what was the state of missionary activity? Was it something important and relatively new, having a rebirth in the middle of the 19th century?
Well, the Christian church has been missionary since the very beginning, really. I mean, it started in a tin pot place in the back of Palestine, you know, and then it's spread everywhere. So the idea is has always been there. But curiously, you know, Napoleon, he did a lot of damage. Like, he got rid of most of the monasteries in Europe, and he did a lot of damage. But when he met his Waterloo, and things went back to normal, there was this kind of, as you said, a rebirth, what they call a springtime of the church. And people went back to their religious traditions with a new spirit, I think. Things never quite go back to the way they were. There's always something new. And so people who believed in the traditions and who shared that faith were aware now that the great powers of Europe were colonizing the world, and so they wanted to go out and spread the Christian faith and the civilization that went with it. And here we're getting quickly into fairly murky waters, as you can tell.
Well, it certainly is, and lots of people will have lots of views, and they won't always be the same when it comes to the what drove the missionaries and how they drove the missionary effort when they got here. But it is an appropriate time to then introduce Salvado into this story. I made some mentions of him earlier. I need to learn much more about him. He left a wonderful legacy generally in Perth, Fremantle, Eunorsia, as we say, Rosendo Street in Cottesloe is a lasting tribute to him. But who was he? How did Martelli meet him?
Well, he was this Spanish monk from a fairly well-to-do background. He was doing his monastic training in Spain when there was a revolution, so he had to leave and go to Italy. And he became a monk in a monastery near Naples, so he spoke perfect Italian. He and a friend of his, Jose Serra, decided to offer themselves to the foreign missions.
They were already, were they Benedictines at that point?
They were. They were monks first and priests second.
And people often think about monasteries and monks as people who've turned their back entirely on life, gone behind the walls, put their heads down and take no notice of the world again. Did the Benedictines have this broader view of the world?
Look, the Benedictines do live separated from the world. That's what a monk is. Person who lives separate from the world, but the Benedictines and other monks were responsible for spreading Christianity through Europe. So Christianity only really existed in southern Europe, you know, sort of Italy, France, Spain, those, until about 600 or 700 AD. And then these monks took off up to Germany, over to England, places like that. And they're all monks who lived very disciplined, ordered lives. Their point of reference was always the cloister, this place that separates them from the world. But the monks also had this vocation, a calling, a belief that they had something to offer the world. So what happened was, Martelli is in Ancona, in the Depression, and he decides, I think what happened was this. On Boxing Day, he went to the opera. Boxing Day, 1850. Because he loved his opera, as Salvado did. They were both cultivated musicians. And the opera that year was Verdi's Nabucco.
Beautiful.
You know, va pensiero. Now, the opera is about the Hebrew people who got captured by the Babylonians and taken in exile. And the Italians at the time, who were trying to liberate their country, said, that's us. We haven't been taken to Babylon, but we've been taken prisoner in our own land. And so when they heard the Hebrew slaves singing that beautiful aria in the third act, Va Pensiero, that some people want that to be Italy's national anthem, they said, oh, that's us. That's us. So I think Martelli, I mean, this is me fantasizing a bit here, but he went to the opera and said, right, that's it, I'm out of here.
It inspired him. He has to do something with his life. He has to
there's nothing I can do here. I've tried, I got burnt, I'm persona non grata. It's just going to be hard yakka to try and get back into anything here. I can go somewhere else and I can do some good somewhere else.
Now, these days, you know, 100 might be the new 60 or something. I'm not sure. As I get older, I'm thinking it probably is, hoping it is. But back then, if you were around 40, it might be a little bit different from people turning 40 today. I remember when I turned 40, I thought I'd suddenly got old. And maybe Martelli thought very much that.
Yeah, I mean, people did live, you know, to old age. Lots died young. But those who got through childhood basically lived to an old age. But he knew he was in the second half of his life. He thought his days were probably numbered and he wanted to do something useful with his life. And I spent some days in Ancona in the library reading the newspapers of the time when he was there. And every now and again there are these stories about missionaries in America, in California. There's even a story about Sydney. There's an article I found there about how the first Archbishop of Sydney was a Benedictine monk, Bishop Polding, and he started a mission and so on. So lots of things kind of came together. Martelli said, right, this is the way I can be of some use. Now, he had an old school friend who was a monk in the Italian town of Subiaco, which we, of course, know is, we know it's supposed to be pronounced Subi, but they call it Subiaco, but that's the Italian way. And so Martelli writes to this fellow and said, look, I'd like to be a monk and I'd like to go to California. Because there was a gold rushes on and they needed priests over there. So this chap said to him, yeah, sure, come down here to Subiaco. You can teach the young monks here for a couple of years while you get yourself ready to go off to California and learn the ways of... So fine, off he went. I should say Martelli did not get official approval from his bishop. I mean, you're not supposed to leave your city without a sign. He didn't get, he just took off. So he goes to Subiaco. A month later, two Spaniards call in.
And you're not going to tell me that Salvado and Serra.
I'm going to tell you it's Salvado and a chap called Garrido.
Garrido, now he Garrido really figures in this story.
Yeah, he was. Garrido's a fascinating and beautiful figure because he's a monk. Like he's a very clever fellow, but he lived his whole life as a monk in service, below the radar, always second to someone else, but did a lot of good. In any case, he was in Italy as Salvado's secretary. Salvado had gone to Subiaco to get monks to take back to New Norcia. He didn't get any then, although they signed agreements in that. He must have met Martelli. So Martelli arrives in September. Salvado calls through for a week in October. And that's all we hear. There's no record of any meeting. 18 months later, Martelli's at the monastery and he hears that Salvado is in Spain, ready to set sail for Australia. He should have gone months ago, but bad weather kept him. Martelli says, I'm out of here.
Wow, now that is a big decision.
Huge. He didn't have a letter of invitation from Salvado. He didn't know that he'd be accepted. He just got permission from his mate in the monastery and off he went.
So where did he have to go?
To Cadiz. Cadiz, which is on the Atlantic coast, just around from the Straits of Gibraltar. Cadiz is the port where all the missionaries went off to South America. So he was there for a few months while the ship got ready. He must have heard stories, you know, as you said, the Spanish in South America, not always covering themselves in glory. But, you know,
but he's met Salvado at this point.
Yeah.
And he's obviously taken with Salvado. There's a friendship. Do you think it obviously grew over time? Or what do you think the state of affairs was when he got to Cadiz?
Well, he said, Martelli said, when he was preparing in Subiaco, he said, I need two things to make a success of this work as a missionary. One, I need a family of people to surround me. These would be other monks and priests. And secondly, I need someone to follow. I need a person who will inspire me and guide me and correct me. It's very interesting that and that's something that I've had to think about a lot as I was writing the book. Because especially, I guess, as Australians, we're very independent. No one's going to tell me what to do. I'll make my own way in life. But actually, myself, I think most of the good things I've learned in life, I've learned by following something or someone or something I've read. So that's what I was saying before, you know, Martelli's taught me a lot. That's one thing he's taught, to think about, sure, independence, but I'm not actually capable of doing everything by myself. I need someone. So Martelli followed. Savanna was a bishop at this stage, so he was a superior. But he was quite short, Savanna's a short man, of tremendous physical strength.
But they were just a bit taller than 5 foot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they were shorter in those days.
Yes.
But terrific energy, learning, education, and conviction, rock solid conviction. Buildings going on around us. So they get to Cadiz, and Salvado must have welcomed him with open arms, and they're off to Australia.
The Australian story starts. We're in Fremantle. We'll jump around a little bit, but he had connections, Martelli, with Fremantle.
He lived in Australia for 27 years, and half of them he lived in Fremantle.
There was a big prison, still is, sits there, looking over Fremantle, keeping us all in order, but it was full of convicts. Soon after he arrived, they built it.
Look, one of the things about that's interesting about Martelli is that almost everything he tried to do went wrong. People just stuck spokes in his wheel at every turn. He came here to go to New Norcia, that's why he came to Australia. The boat lands, Bishop Serra comes out to meet them all and says, oh, sorry, it's all off, New Norcia's shut down. I'm turning it into a farm. And all the money from Unorcia is going to come to Perth because we've got to worry about this city which is growing with the convicts and the pensioner guards and the Irish girls. Or we need to worry about white people, not black people. It was as basic as that. It was as crude as that. So all of a sudden, Martelli's on the other side of the world, and the reason why he's here has just been cut out from under his feet. But he obeys. He obeys. He follows Salvado and says, well, okay, I'm here for something which is bigger than me. And if I'm going to make a go of this, I've got to accept that things won't happen the way I want them to happen, but it's part of a bigger picture. So he put his head down.
Well, you have to remember that listeners needed to somehow take this in. I don't know how you do it, but you have to realise that the Swan River colony was all of 24 years in 53, settled around about June 29, he arrives in August 53. Fremantle, as you look at it today, wasn't here. The buildings you see, the famous West End that we look out on as we chat, that doesn't come until the gold rushes in the 1890s. The place was settled, the streets were laid out, and things were happening, although Martelli in his descriptions didn't think too much of it. He was looking for something else. The prisoners arrived because the settlers decided they need the free labour, and they all come in on the last of the convicts in 1868 on the Hougoumont, including lots of Irish. But it's built up through this period.
Yeah.
So Martelli must have really had to adapt to being a colonist in many ways.
Well, I hate to disappoint your listeners, but he never really said he liked Fremantle. He said it was a sad shore, sad, sandy shore, you know. which is strange because he grew up in a port.
I had exactly the same feeling when I read that in your book. And I'm thinking, hang on, have a look at this painting of Ancona, lovely bay, and we don't have the old buildings and all of that. But he needed to be a little bit more generous. But I suspect he got it and he wanted to get in. He wanted to get to the countryside where New Norcia was, I imagine.
Yeah, well, exactly. And he spent all his time in Fremantle trying to get out of the place to go to New Norcia, even though he was here for 13 years. Look, when the convicts started coming in 1850, I think the population of the colony was around 4,000 or 5,000 people. It's tiny. And it's basically Fremantle, Perth and Guildford. They're the three settlements along the river. And a few other bits and pieces, but everyone must have known everyone else. With 4,000 people, you knew exactly who was doing what to whom. So Martelli comes from this bustling cities of Europe with all the history and ends up in this tin pot place of a very few people, sandy place, you can't grow anything, it's too hot. And he's not allowed to do what he wanted to do. But look, he put his head down and straight away he was sent to Fremantle. So he arrived here in January 1854. Fremantle's first Italian priest. You know, we all know about the Italian priests. After the war, Father Nanni is very famous among the Italians. But 100 years before that, this is one of the
important markers in the book. This was the first Italian parish priest of Fremantle, really.
Yeah. And he worked as a parish priest for a year and then got moved to the prison the year after. So in his first 2 years, he saw the town and he saw the jail.
Didn't like the prison all that much, and particularly if you come out here to save souls. Some of the convicts, you probably think, oh, well, I'm not sure that we can do a lot there. A few of them will have been Irish. Do you think any of them were Italian? What was the sort of ethnic mix in a place? And did Martelli have much English?
The people in those days seemed to learn languages very well. They didn't have computers or Duolingo or anything, but they all seem to have lots of languages. In fact, you know, if you look at the history of Western Australia in the 19th century, one of the things that surprised me as I read these stories was how many different nationalities and languages there were. And I think that our view of the old days is kind of, it's filtered through federation, you know. And as soon as Australia becomes a federation in 1901, the country starts to define itself as British, or, you know, British to the bootstraps, as the great man said. And so, you know, we had the laws about Aboriginal people, we had the White Australia policy, the dictation test, the whole business. Before federation, there wasn't this kind of hang-up about, oh, we've got to be a British colony. Of course it was a British colony. But all the priests in the diocese for the first few years, all the Catholic priests, were Spaniards or French or Belgians or Italians or Czechs or Germans. And there's a beautiful book by a Fremantle identity called J.B. Riley, who said the old Spanish priests used to come and preach to us and they were a bit hard to understand, really. Their English wasn't too good. But their best sermons were their lives. And it's a beautiful reminder that, you know, we can just relax a little bit about this language thing. I think these days, modern Australia, we're a bit hung up about people with different languages that we don't understand. And I know I've mentioned him before, but I mentioned him again. You know, J.D. Vance, you know, made a statement a little while ago saying with migrants, you know, you don't want to have people living around you, on either side of you, who are speaking different languages. They might be talking about you. Imagine that. We've got a bit of that hang-up, I think, in modern Australia. And it's a modern hang-up. 100, 200 years ago, people were very relaxed. They all spoke different languages and they all got on.
And this comes through in your book, John. And it's because, I suppose, again, pioneers, early colonists, people out there, you have to know what you're doing. You mightn't have, you know, fixed a machine when you left Italy or Ireland or England or somewhere and finished up here. But you have to learn how to do that, and you have to get on with people. So our Martelli, he's here, he's down at the prison, he's generally around Fremantle. Does he ever make it to New Norcia, or does he actually have to go through a whole lot of, I don't know, sort of an odyssey before he gets there?
Look, it's hard for us to understand, I think, today, Michael, that priests then, and religious life even today, is a process where an intelligent, mature, competent adult deliberately chooses to submit themselves to a higher authority. In our modern society, that's an odd concept, but that's the essence of it. And Martelli said at one stage, he said, I know that what's happened to me is wrong. Like the bishop did this and someone else did that. But he said, as I look around, the only people who are actually building things at last are people who obey and who follow something else. And I found that really challenging because I'm thinking, no, say something, do something. You're intelligent. You know what's going on. Speak up for yourself. But he uses intelligence to understand that it's not all about me. It's about me being part of something bigger. So he put his head down and learned to get on with people. I mean, he comes from a very kind of privileged background. Here he is mixing with all sorts of people. He detested the work in the jail. He hated it. He found it a brutal place. No great credit to a Christian government. And I have to mention something that might make some listeners feel uncomfortable, but he suffered badly from hemorrhoids all his life. There are lots of hemorrhoids in the book, as you probably see. Lots of people did. I mean, their diets weren't too good, and they spent a lot of time on horseback, so it was uncomfortable. But he did say famously once, you said the prison's looming. He said, the prison affects my spirit the same way the hemorrhoids affect my body.
Well, and all of this comes through in the book. You realise, here's this guy. He's on his own. Then as now, priests in the Catholic Church take vows of celibacy. He doesn't seem to have had a relationship as a younger man. He went into the seminary and came through. There's some interesting little twists in the book that don't go anywhere, John, but he seems to be aware that there are some controversies happening here and there that get reported to the bishop, I think. Things happening. But there must be, at the same time, not just in the prison, a growing number of Catholics in the community. And he's out there. I mean, we haven't an idea of the numbers and where they are.
Well, the Catholics were always a minority, of course, although there was quite a lot of Catholic prisoners, because the Irish, obviously, being sent away by the English. Well, when he arrived, I think the Catholics in Fremantle were 200 or 300, with about 400 prisoners. The Catholics at the time were in Fremantle, Perth and Dardanup, just out of Bunbury.
Now, there'll be people who know this, I didn't. Dardanup seems to be the centre of early days Catholicism in Western Australia.
It's curious how things go. See, what happened was they built the monastery in New Norcia, and then they built a second monastery just near Lake Munger, at a place called New Subiaco. Now, that monastery got knocked down, but when they put the railway station through, they decided to call it Subiaco to remember the old monastery.
And the home of Good Shepherd isn't that far away.
That's exactly right. They wanted to build a third monastery, which never happened, at Dardanup. Of course, why wouldn't you build a monastery at Dardanup? Well, there was an Irishman there called Thomas Little, who was working for the guy called Princep. He was breeding horses on the National Peninsula and sending them up to India. And Thomas Little brought lots of Irish workers to work with him. So there was a huge population,
relatively speaking.
Yeah, so maybe 100, but by those times it was a large concentration of Catholics in the Dardanup area, all working for Thomas Little or with Thomas Little. And so the first Catholic church in the state outside Perth of Fremantle was built in Dardanup, and Martelli and Salvado were there for the foundation stone.
And it's these parts of the story, that, leaving aside the problems being mobile on a horse, emphasise the mobility of, well, of people generally. But there's Salvado, there's Martelli, they're heading off there and around about. And we know Martelli finishes up in 2J.
Look, it's interesting. We think that we're so mobile these days and our phones can, you know, get us in touch with everybody. When Martelli was first in Fremantle in the 1850s, the postal service was a horse. But then the steamers, the steamer boats came in the mid-50s. And so there was a mail collection twice a day. You could send a letter to Perth from Fremantle in the morning. You might, that would get to Perth in the evening. They'd reply to you overnight, put it on the boat the next morning, and you'd get it that evening. So by our, I mean, Australia Post is not that efficient today.
Which they need to get the steamer and the horse.
Yeah. So people are... coped with the distances and the technology of riding around on horses and carts extremely well. What happened was, because the convicts increased numbers of population and also made the place more profitable, the priests started to get sent out to different places where there were convict depots. So, you know, convicts who'd done their time or who'd been good behaviour could go out and go to a depot and get hired for work. So there's one in 2J, and so Martelli was sent there for 2 years. Poor as a church mouse, he got there with no money. He said, this famous letter he wrote back, I'm sleeping on the floor, living on potatoes and rotten eggs. Now, this is a guy from a, you know, he loved to, loved the Avon Valley, loved it, loved the people. And he built the first church in 2J, it no longer stands, but he built the first church there.
He came out here with that missionary zeal, having met the Benedictines in Subiaco, met Salvado and being impressed. And as we know, we'll come back to the technical side of you, accessing all of this data. He probably thought he was going to help save the indigenous people of Australia. Do you think he harboured that sort of ambition? Did he ever get anywhere near it?
Well, now we're getting down to the heart of why he came. See, Salvado said right from the beginning that he was here for the conversion and civilization of the Aboriginal people. Now, those words to us today in 2026 kind of get alarm bells ringing. But of course, we're talking 200 years ago, and the world was a different place. Salvado and Martelli, too, had a what looks like a kind of a contradiction, really, in the way they thought about Aboriginal people. Mind you, we've got contradictions in the way we think about Aboriginal. They're just different contradictions. They believed, as people did then, that all human societies developed the same way, from basically from the Stone Age up to agriculture and industry and cities. Every single human culture developed the same way. Because we're all one big human family. Europeans were just lucky that they'd done it first. The Aboriginal people in Australia hadn't had the chance to get on that road to development. So it was the job of Europeans to help them. Now, the British government wasn't all that interested in doing it, so the missionary said, we'll do it. Now, it might look to us today as if the missionaries were trying to rip the Aboriginal people out of their traditional cultures into modern European culture. But I think that was already happening. The colonists had done that. I think what the missionaries are saying, well, we can't stop that because the British government, the British Empire is stronger than us. What we can do is give the Aboriginal people what they need to survive in this new world. So Salvado, you know, sets up a village in New Norcia where he's got the monks and the Aboriginal people working side by side. He paid his workers, whereas many people didn't pay Aboriginal workers. He paid them. He built houses for Aboriginal people who got married. So there's always a trade. They had to get married in the church, but if they did, they had a house. This is Salvado. He wanted to show the British that, in fact, Aboriginal people have the same potential as white people. So he formed a cricket team. That's a very famous story, how they walked to Perth, and as you do. They played a game in Perth and lost, but then they walked to Fremantle and beat the local team, the sons of all the leading families, which was a shock. When he established a telegraph office in New Norcia, the first postmistress was an Aboriginal woman from Bunbury, Helen Pangeru. So he's, and the governor came through, not the governor, the superintendent or something of telegraph, had heard that there was a black woman and didn't believe it. And so somebody said, come and watch this. So he was on a mission, if you'll pardon the expression, to show the British that actually all human beings have the same potential. It's just about giving people the opportunity and the time to develop. That's what Martelli came here to do. But
he got sidetracked.
He got stuck in Frio, poor fella.
He eventually finds his way up to New Norcia.
Mm.
How old was he? At what stage of his life, and how did that go?
Well, he'd been here for about 15 years. He'd worked a lot of time in the prison and just couldn't wait to get out. He'd become a British subject. I think he was the first Italian to become a British citizen. And he only did it so he could get paid for working in the prison. And after 15 years, finally, he gets permission, because the bishop was short of priests and he wanted to keep him here. Anyway, he got out and goes to New Norcia, 1868, he gets to New Norcia. And that goes wrong as well. Things just kept going wrong because the world had changed. See, it was only 15 years, but the colonial frontier had expanded and kept moving east and kept moving north. And so relations between European settlers or missionaries and Aboriginal people were just becoming more and more difficult. More and more difficult. And he imagined that he could do the same as Salvado, could just go out there and meet people and bring them into town and offer them this and offer them that. But the Aboriginal people had some very negative experiences, and they weren't going anywhere near European missionaries.
There's a famous, well, it's a scene really in the book, where he goes with one of his colleagues who gets him to go up Geraldton Way, really to try and encourage, I think, children to go to the school in New Norcia and to further Salvado's dream in that sense, and it doesn't go well.
No, that's a very difficult story. Difficult to read, it's painful to read, and it was very difficult for me to write. Also because, you know, this is 2026 and we know a lot of stuff that's happened in the last 150 years, which Martelli didn't know. So he went, so New Norcia ran two schools, a school for Aboriginal boys, Aboriginal girls. They only taught white children after. The schools lost students because diseases came through and kids were dying in around this part of Western Australia. So they decided to go north to see if there were Aboriginal kids up there who would come down to the mission, be taught, and then either get jobs in town or whatever. So he went north to look for children to bring to the school. Now that is a very, very, you know, difficult thing to say in 2026. But I think, see, in Italy, he believed that education was the way to emancipate poor Italian kids. He said, the children of the poor are always at the mercy of unscrupulous men in society. In Italy. So when he comes to Australia, he says, well, who are the poorest of the poor here? Aboriginal kids. So it's my job to rescue these kids from these terrible situations that they've been put in because of the colonial conflict and bring them back to New Norcia. You know, we could discuss this for a long time because it's very difficult, very complicated. But basically what happens is he goes up there and he's traumatised. He's traumatised because he realises that the parents of these... He finds a group of people, Aboriginal people. He realises that the parents think that he's going to grab the kids by force and carry them kicking and screaming back to New Norcia, and is completely traumatised.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast, John. We could have just said, talk about a lot of these issues for a long time, but this biography is about Raffaele Martelli, this man who arrives from Italy here. He's 42, dies in 1880s, coming up 70.
Mm-hmm.
He knew he was quite unwell towards the end. He finds his way to New Norcia to die there. It's a beautifully written part of the book towards the end when he passes away. It's very touching. Do you think he died content? Do you think we can be sort of content about what he did and how it all went for him coming here?
Look, when that terrible story happened up in Port Gregory, just north of Geraldton, he went back to New Norcia and he basically said, I can't stay here, there's nothing I can do. I'm not a monk. I can't get Aboriginal kids, this is not going to work. So he went back to 2J and was there for 8 years.
And was much loved.
Much loved, because his passion in life was people, basically. And he loved people as fellow children of the one God. No matter what race people were or religion or anything else, they're all children of the one creator. So, you know, 2J and Northern were tiny little villages at that time. Most of his prisoners were out on the farm. So he was on the farm, on the horse, with his hemorrhoids, visiting all these poor people. And there's a story I tell in the book where someone saw him once ordering a pair of trousers. And he asked them to have a bit of extra length in the leg so he could tuck them into his socks when he was sleeping out in the barns so that the vermin wouldn't crawl up his legs. I mean, life was very, very tough. But, you know, there are other beautiful stories out there. There's the lion of Northern, the kind of boss man of Northern, a guy called George Throssell. He became premier at one stage. I'm not sure, but he's certainly in the parliament. Throssell was the mayor of Northern, and he had Martelli to lunch one Sunday, Sunday lunch, with the Anglican priest. And at the beginning of the meal, Throssell, who was a Methodist, turned to the Anglican priest and said, would you say the prayer? Huh? They had their meal. And at the end of the meal, he turned to Martelli and said, would you say the meal? Now, I was stunned to read that when I came across it, because, you know, I grew up in the 60s when Catholics and Protestants didn't like each other much.
Sectarianism meant something.
Terrible thing, you know, the 50s and 60s. But back in the 1870s, see, Martelli knew that Catholicism was right and Protestant were wrong. So there's no problem about that. But they're religions. People are people. And so when he's at a dinner table, sure, the Anglican priest says the prayer first and the Catholic priest says the prayer second. So he would work with anyone to help people basically build a better life for themselves. And so he came to love the people out there. They're as poor as church mice. He built First Church in Northern. He built schools. all for the good of the people.
And so if one wants to measure someone's life and say whether they, to use totally inappropriate terms, whether they were successful, he lived a successful priestly life. Do you think?
Successful, that's a word I hadn't thought about in terms of Martin. Of course, I don't think...
Satisfying? Did he achieve his, did he achieve his own religious ambitions or his his own commitment was to the Catholic Church?
Well, I think he came to understand more deeply what his commitment was. He thought his commitment was to make Italy a unified political place. Wrong. He thought he could come to Australia to spread the faith among the Aboriginal people. Wrong. He thought he could come here and build churches and schools everywhere. Wrong. So what was it all about? One thing that helped me think this through was that he wrote letters to Soldado all the time, and that's basically where the book started, with these letters, 400 letters. But for those last 8 years when he's in 2J, there are basically like half a dozen letters, nothing. Now, he did ride across once or twice a year to New Norcia to see the people and that. But I think, and I've got nothing to go on but what I know about the man, I think that he reached a situation where he realised that this was his home. His home was not Rome, Ancona, Perth, the big city. It was 2J, a place of a few hundred people, and Irish families on these farms scattered all around the Avon Valley. That was his home. And all the gifts he had, all the education and the training and the experience, was all put at the service of the people of that place. Was he successful? I think he discovered who he was. The hard way, it wasn't an easy way. And so when he left the Throssell family, they wept on each other's shoulders, this Catholic priest and this Methodist family.
And I think, John, that is a perfect place to end this discussion. Man born 1811 in Ancona, Italy, arrives in Fremantle in August 1853, dies in New Norcia in 1880, never goes back to Italy, and is remembered so beautifully in your book. You must have just loved researching, writing it, and now having it here.
I loved it. It was hard work, partly because there are 400 letters he wrote to Salvado, but no letters that he received. Either he burnt them or chucked them in a corner and someone chucked them out. So you've only got half the story. But the other thing I loved about the story was that you came across so many different sides of life in West Australia. Just mention one more. I know this has gone on a long time, but he met the first Italian woman who came to Fremantle, whose name was Nicoletta Salustri, or Salastri, I think we say. Now, she was from Ancona or a town nearby, married an Irish soldier, came here, had 8 children, and she was his parishioner in Fremantle. There is a photograph of her around in a very old age. And I was thrilled to see that the Fremantle City Council named a street after her in North Fremantle a few years ago. That part where it's overlooking the river. I can't think of the street now, but in any case, there's a Salustri place. And it's beautiful that this basically humble, unknown Italian woman, the first Italian woman coming, has now got a street named after her. And she was a friend of Martelli's.
John, I'm encouraging everyone to read this. It tells you history, tells you European history, particularly Italian. It brings what's going on with the papacy. There are so many sort of connections with the world today. It's not all that long ago when you stop and think about it. It introduces you to Fremantle, it takes you to Darden up Bunbury, up in York and Northern and 2J in particular, New Norcia, Geraldton, Champion Bay. It's a wonderful book. Congratulations.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thanks, Michael.